Blog Talk Radio.
News Director Rick Spezak welcome you to another adventure in Progressive News Network. We've got some fantastic guests tonight, and we have a very exciting show. And I chose tonight to use the jungle music because, my dear friends, it is a jungle out there. And if we don't work together, the 1%ers are going to own your grandchildren outright. They've clearly already purchased the government. We can tell because their servants in Congress and in the White House seem to be going that extra mile to make sure that all those public institutions are turned over for profit. And I typically like to do my news segments right at the top, but we've got a guest already, and by gum, I'm inclined to ask them on. Hello there and welcome. Is this Kit?
Oh, yes, it is. I'm sorry. I didn't know if I was first or not.
Well, you're first, Kit. You're the first with the most. You've had a very exciting couple of weeks because your press releases have been fantastic. You are taking the battle for human rights, for fair justice for working people to the streets. And I have to salute you. The work that you're doing is tremendous. So I'm going to put the news aside for a minute, and I'm going to say, Kit, what the hell's going on?
You know, we're asking that same question, as well as even the Miami Herald is asking that question.
I've noticed that. That's amazing.
You know, the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey has identified the city of Miami as one of the highest poverty rates and one of the lowest median incomes among large U.S. cities. And the U.S. Census Bureau has identified Miami-Dade County as having the second highest income inequality of the 25 largest counties in the country, and a poverty rate of 18%.
Kit, let me ask you a question. Hold on, let me interrupt you just for a second.
Sure.
Hey, Kit, isn't it time that the public build another sports stadium?
You know, it's so interesting that they want to give welfare to millionaires, billionaires, but they want to take away in Miami-Dade County some of the things that help the working poor, such as the Responsible Wages Ordinance. That is to ensure that contractors pay prevailing wages and give health coverage to construction workers on county projects.
Well,
Senator,
you know,
Alan Hayes and Representative Van Zandt, they don't like that anymore.
No, in fact, I've heard it on the highest Republican authority, which of course is unimpeachable, that all they're trying to do is give those poor corporations, you know, they're so troubled by their insecurities, you know. They just don't know what's going to happen, the poor dears. Unlike the security that, you know, working people have in this right to be unemployed state.
Exactly. And you know what else they're trying to do? They're trying to, Representative Stephen Precourt has filed a bill, and it was passed by the House on Thursday. And that would preempt not only the longstanding living wage ordinances, such as we have in the city of Miami, Miami Beach, and Miami-Dade County, but it would also take away other benefits that local governments deem appropriate for their communities, including equal benefits ordinances and sick time. David Simmons, Senator David Simmons, has filed Senate Bill 726, and that would limit the ability of local governments to determine if medical leave is appropriate for a particular sector of workers.
Well, you see, you know, those poor corporations like, well, you know, Disney and you know, across
the Florida, the Florida Retail Federation is the big culprit in this. And the head of the Florida Retail Federation is Paul Imbro, and he is Macy's lobbyist in Tallahassee. You know, and Macy's tries to do good work in each community by giving community grants to local groups that help the poor, but at the same time taking away, with the other hand, things like wage theft protections that people in Miami-Dade have. And we presented the store manager of the downtown store with a petition and a letter, one letter from the South Florida AFL-CIO, decrying these policies, and the other one from a group that had 48 unions and community groups signed on to and said, really stop messing with people that are going to spend money in your store. It doesn't make any economic sense for them to oppose these things that have helped the working poor bring themselves up into the middle class.
Well, you know, Florida has such a reputation for being very generous in its wages, compensations,
oh, yes.
and benefit packages. Obviously, this is a problem that Tallahassee has to look into because there are people that actually, you know, want to give people sick leave. Can you imagine?
I know. Can you imagine that the 45% of people living in Miami-Dade County, most of whom are low-wage service workers in the restaurant industry, hotel industry, and other hospitality industries, they are the ones that get absolutely no earned sick time. Most are really the most impacted by this are women who tend to be the caretakers in their families. And if a child gets sick and has to be sent home from school, what does the mother do? Go without a paycheck or leave the child at home alone? It's not a choice that anybody should have to make.
Well, you see, the state of Florida and our good Republican-led government is so concerned about Florida citizens that you see they'd like to make schools spend extra money so that corporations can have profits too. The level of concern is just, I mean, Mother Teresa would be proud of them. But hold on 1 minute while we get back to a subject, and I'm going to bring on another one of our guests tonight. I think this is the charming and talented Hans from Tallahassee who's going to give us some perspective from Tallahassee. Hans, is this you?
Yes, it would be me. Good evening, Rick. How are you tonight?
Good evening, sir. We have Kit Rafferty on for Jobs for Justice, Hans. And,
good evening, Kit. How are you?
Fine, thanks, Hans. How are you?
We were just talking about the good people in Tallahassee. There are a few Democrats, so Hans, you'll forgive me with this. But those incredible legislators who are so concerned about Florida, they're afraid too many people are getting, you know, a fair wage or sick time off. Why don't you tell us a little bit of what you're hearing up there, the ground truth, boots on the ground sort of view up there in Tallahassee, Hans?
I'll be happy to. But before I start, I do want to preface my comments by saying a fond farewell to somebody from the other side of the aisle who I met through my tenure at the Department of Business and Professional Regulation. My dear friend Ed DePue. And even though Ed was a lifelong Republican, I believe he was on Claude Kirk's security detail, which kind of gives you a sense of how far back he goes, and he was a director in one of the divisions. But Ed exemplified the fact that even though we were on different sides of the aisle, we could still be good friends and be civil and communicate with one another, which is in many, many respects that which we are sorely missing at the national level, at the state level, and unfortunately, as Kit points out, it seems to have infiltrated to the local level. Rick, your comment about when do Tea Partiers, this is on the website here. When do Tea Partiers hate local government? When it disagrees with them? Well, you know, at some point, the clear and obvious goal here is the complete destruction of any form of government and or regulation. And with of course, a couple of obvious exceptions, such as, let's say, the military. But beyond that, I had a chance earlier this week, or last week, I should say, to read again the Lewis Powell memo from 1970 or 71. And I would encourage all your listeners to read that and read it carefully, especially now in hindsight. Because what Lewis Powell laid out, and again the irony, once he got appointed to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, he actually was a very moderate, not progressive, but a moderate voice on the U.S. Supreme Court. But what he laid out in the Powell memo is what we see today, the complete conquering of the government, of the media, of most facets of our life in America by the corporate structure. Now, you know, he wrote and was bemoaning, and he used the example of William Kunstler talking about how we've got to take out corporations and businesses. Well, that would have self-moderated. It would have been self-moderated. It would have come, it would have gone. But the truth of the matter is that the gauntlet was laid down. And because the this memo, by the way, was to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He advocated calling for an activist business community in government, in politics, in media. Think tanks were born and funded appropriately, which quite frankly was a direct line from that 1970-71 memo from Lewis Powell all the way through Citizens United and the Koch brothers. And along the way, our dear 40th president said government's not the solution, it's the problem, became the mantra. And it had to be destroyed. And how many times was it always prefaced? Well, it's the federal government. It's best to turn these things back to the state and local governments because they know best. Well, you know, that's a non-discriminatory sort of a thing. Government's government's government, and it's all bad. It all needs to be thrown out. And to heck with environmental regulations, to heck with clean food, clean water, et cetera. And the sense I have here, ground zero at Tallahassee, is that we're getting to the point now where this nirvana that they have sought is coming about. No regulations on growth, no regulations on the environment. To heck with the working man and woman. To heck with their medical care. To heck with their retirement years. If they can't take care of themselves, let them die of hunger on the street. Just so long as we can squeeze out, or our friends can squeeze out an extra dime of profit. And it's a sad shape, state of affairs when that seems to be the thing that's governing our legislature.
Well, let me ask you to stop right there for a minute, Hans. Kit, you have been taking it to the streets. Why don't you tell us about one of your recent actions?
We had a great action at Representative Eddie Gonzalez's office. He is the chair of the Miami-Dade delegation, and he actually voted in committee for House Bill 655, which eliminates all the ordinances, the wage theft ordinance, the living wage ordinance, all the things that help working people. He is from one of the poorest districts in Miami-Dade County.
A man of the people.
Right, a real man of the people. So we decided We had asked him four times for a meeting to explain what he was doing and how wrong it was and how bad it was for the people that he represents. He refused to meet with us for four times. Well, if you've refused to meet with us, we have to go to you. So we went, we had a great rally and press conference in front of his office, and then we went into his office. And the staff left the door open. Apparently they were fearful of the working people because they don't care much for them.
They'd never actually met one in person.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they don't meet with them because they don't want to. We requested four times. And so what was very interesting, there was a big empty chair. And so we put a few signs on the empty chair. We put our letter from 48 unions and community groups on the chair and took a picture of the empty chair for the empty suit, Representative Eddie Gonzalez.
Incredible. You know, go ahead, Hans.
And if I may ask you, you know, he refused to meet with you. I find that that our friends on the right side of the aisle actually have this major disdain for small d democracy and Democrats and people who want to be a part of the political process. Now, kid, if you came armed with a 6 or 7 figure check, you not only would have been met, you'd have had a nice dinner, you would have been shown the town, et cetera, but
right.
As a constituent, they don't want anything to do with you.
And let me say something right here. You know, that when you ask for an appointment and they don't find time, that's understandable. A second time, maybe a third time. But, you know, I find it so difficult to believe that they couldn't even find some aide that could meet with you. So that clearly says this is not about timing. This is not about finding a place to have someone meet. This is simple disdain for the constituents who live in that person's district. And, you know,
excuse me, Rick, the problem is, and this is the thing that frustrates me the most, the problem is there's no consequence for their actions. There was a story, I think it was the St. Pete Times, Tampa Bay Times political editor, wrote a piece, this was just before the session started, about how several legislators, several lobbyists representing the eye doctor industry, and several eye doctors had a dinner in a private room at a local restaurant here in Tallahassee. Well, they claimed that they didn't discuss business. Give me a break. But there's no consequence. There's no, you know, they're going to get reelected. They're not worried about their power base. They just laugh at that sort of thing. They laugh at people like Kip. They laugh at people like me. They don't need us, and there's no consequence for them treating us like dirt.
Well, I think Kit and the group of people who she has brought together, who Jobs with Justice and the allied people who've come together, are going to make a difference. If we have any shreds of democracy left, this is what it's going to take, making people aware of just who owns these creatures, because they are certainly not servants of the people. That's for sure.
Well, one of the things that we have done is we have gone to the city of Miami and the city of Miami Beach, who also have living wage laws, and we believe that the city of Miami will be passing a resolution against the usurpation of the power to manage the living wage. And we know that that the city of Miami Beach is absolutely opposed to it and has taken our side on this issue, the politicians there, not just the League of Cities or counties. These are the actual mayors of both cities who have understand what this does for their constituents and why in the heck somebody from Palatka can tell Miami-Dade City Commission, County Commission, what to do about how to serve their constituents is beyond belief.
Okay, let me bring in another guest. This is Diana Demarest, a longtime political operative, someone who's helped get people elected. Diana, welcome.
Thank you for having me today, Richard. I appreciate it.
Diana, you've heard some of this discussion. We've got representatives in Florida government who clearly wouldn't give a constituent the time of day unless they've got a five-figure or six-figure check in front of them. What, now, Kit has been bringing people together. What kind of reaction do you have? What kind of suggestion do you have to get the attention of this obviously blindfolded legislature who's marching to the tune of a dollar sign?
Well, it quite honestly, it goes beyond the dollar sign. When you look at legislative, especially what they call these preemptive bills, which preempts local governments from home rule, from making up their own ordinances, their own rules and regulations regarding different topics, you'll find there is a strand that's very common through all of them, or most of them at the very least. And it's an organization called ALEC. And if you have not heard of ALEC, it's the American Legislative Exchange Council. And what ALEC is they claim they're not a lobbying group, but what they are is they are a national organization made up of multinational corporations that come up with model bills that they bestow upon all 50 states. It's basically like having 50 lobbyists. Now, they claim they're not a lobbyist organization. They claim that they are, in fact, a quote-unquote issue-oriented organization, and so therefore are not considered lobbyists, although they are listed as a nonprofit. But just to kind of give you an idea of some of the bills that I'm talking about, and these are bills that the Florida League of Cities, for instance, is against. Right now they have one out there called the Right to Farm Act, which basically says that no local government can make regulation regarding any operation that's on anything that's agribusiness that's considered to be a farming operation. This includes pesticides, the way they take care of animal waste or agri-waste. And so that's on the ALEC side. We have the Right to Farm Act. And what they have, if you go to their website, is model legislation. And what they do is they take these template bills. People call them a bill mill. And they take these bills, and you can fill in the blanks in your state and every state as to how these will conform to your state legislature. So on the one hand, we have the ALEC Right to Farm Act. On the other hand, here in Florida, currently sitting in the House, is H. Bill 927, which preempts local governments from adopting any ordinance, regulation, or rule that restricts or otherwise limits agriculture if their land is classified as agriculture. You have another one. The Stand Your Ground Act is another perfect example of an ALEC bill, which prohibits local governments from prohibiting guns in schools, government buildings. So it's really more pervasive because these are guys that take boilerplate legislation, which in a lot of times, in many circumstances, preempts local government from making any rules and regulations, and they go to every state. For instance, ALEC has a bill out there, or a model, what they call quote-unquote model bill, that prohibits local governments from producing a broadband in their municipality. So let's say, like right now, you can go down to the city of Delray Beach, you can go out on Atlantic Avenue, and you can log in broadband. The city provides broadband for free. Well, right now, ALEC has a bill out there that's going to prohibit local governments from providing broadband to their citizens, even though in a lot of circumstances they either can't afford it or it's not available in their territory. Right now, the retirement system bill which is on the League of Cities watch list, Bill 7011, for instance, takes all new government employees and dumps them into a 401k plan rather than the Florida pension system. And again, this bill is being introduced all over the country and in states all over the United States to make all these things uniform. That's where these voter bills came from. This is where you have the so-called parent trigger bill, which is, and they're so pervasive in education right now, and of course Jeb Bush is all over this as well.
Let me stop you right there for a minute, Diana. Sure. That's excellent information. Kit, let me ask you a question. clearly you and the other constituencies coming together in this alliance are considering alternative strategies. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of alternative strategies you're looking at, either ways to confront your legislator to confront them more, or some other tactic? What kind of considerations are you giving? Because clearly so far these tactics haven't produced the results we all know that Florida needs.
Well, what we try and do is what we did to Eddie Gonzalez. We're doing, you know, phone calls into their districts, and not robocalls, but the calls where we give them a number, what we call patch-through calls. And I don't think the people that live in the districts, such as the district of Eddie Gonzalez, understand what's happening to them. They're hardworking people who live on the edge of poverty. And with information that makes them angry enough, we hope to put pressure on them that way by doing patch-through calls. We were able to do that to get the wage theft ordinance passed here, and we have a really good database for making those calls to a certain demographic. And I think that's the only way that these politicians are going to wake up. And I think Alec has played a huge role in all of these as well, because we can track all the paid sick day bills going through all the legislatures right now, and they're almost similar.
Hans, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that Alec is brought up. In my opening comments, I mentioned the Lewis Powell memo. Alec is one of the direct results of that. It was founded in 1973. The Lewis Powell memo was written. It was released August 23rd, 1971. A direct result of what he suggested. Led to the organization that we now know as ALEC, as well as with the Business Roundtable, Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Manhattan Institute. All of these things out of that particular memo, and I would encourage your listeners, I'd encourage everyone who this broadcast touches, read that, know the history. It really helps prepare you for the battles that we're engaged in.
That's excellent. Kit, let me ask you this. I think it's fantastic that you've been able to get these municipal groups to be involved as well. The city of Miami, and you said what other city was it?
Yeah, a city of Miami Beach, both of whom have living wage laws, and both of whose mayors really oppose their Tallahassee's interference with what is best for their constituents. We are not Palatka. We are not Northern Florida. We are a city of immigrants, a vibrant city where the stretch between the very, very wealthy and the very, very poor is one of the worst in the country. And mayors and city councils and city commissions want to respond to what is needed to bring people in their areas, in their city, at least partially to the middle class. So we have done that. We have a few surprise activities that
I bet
won't
you do. Kit, before you go any further, I got to ask you, I know there are lots of people out there who want to support your organization. Why don't you give us the website and maybe an email address, so the people who want to support the actions that you're doing, so that they can get in touch with you and bring whatever support resources they can. Go and give us your website, huh?
Our website is under construction at the moment. We're raising money to build a better, smarter website. But
okay.
I do that for a living, you know.
Okay, let me bring on one more guest. This is
Before you do that, I wanted to mention about this Living Wage Act, because it's interesting that and I caught this earlier when you were speaking about it. One of the things that Alec is pushing nationally right now is called the Living Wage Mandate Preemption Act, and it basically repeals any local living wage mandate ordinances or laws enacted by political subdivisions. And when they say political subdivisions, they mean municipalities. So this is a big one that is on Alex's agenda for the 2013 session.
Well, thanks, Diana. Okay, let me bring Curtis Carpenter on. He's a Democratic Party activist in Indian River County. Let me bring on Curtis Carpenter. Curtis.
Hi, Rick. How you doing, Rick?
Very good, sir. Very good. Why don't you give us some reaction from the from a little bit further north in the state? What kind of things are you hearing about this government preemption, this kind of solid wall of hypocrisy coming out of Tallahassee?
It seems like the biggest thing around here is the education thing, the trigger bill that they've pushed through. That along with actually locally here, that's kind of been paired with Common Core standards, which I haven't heard discussed yet on the show. But between the trigger bill being passed and then locally in this county, they're trying to rid the county's school district from Common Core standards, which if you guys don't know much about it, 48 out of the 50 states have adopted this Common Core, I don't really want to say agenda, but this idea that all school systems in the county, city, county, state, throughout the country kind of go on the same curriculum to make sure that our children are ready for college and for the workforce. And we have a big Tea Party following in this county, and they're really trying to push against that. So the trigger bill is kind of the basis to get charter schools involved around here to rid this Common Core thing. And that's really the biggest reaction that I've heard from Democrats in Indian River County.
Let me stop now. I'm going to ask you all the same question. Now, for years, we've been hearing the Republican mantra that big government is bad, that all civil servants are evil, and that only small government is good. Now, how can we reconcile that long-term Tea Party, Republican Party meme with the fact that here we've got a situation where, no, thank you very much, one size fits all for education, one size fits all across the states, that we can't have local control and local decision-making. Let me ask you first, Kit, how do those two things fit together, Kit?
Well, I mean, I think it's very interesting because when it comes to marriage equality, they want to be in the middle of that, right? That's where government wants to be, their side of the government. Also, when it comes to women's reproductive rights, boy, they're right in my womb, aren't they?
Yep.
So mine too.
I would say they're bought and sold by big business, and that's what Alec is about. And that's what they're all about, is their next campaign and their next camp check for their campaign.
Hans, let me ask the same question.
And yet the irony here is that there is a certain stability to their beliefs. Kit brought up about being in a woman's uterus. How does one reconcile the fact that most of those on the right side of the aisle are, quote, pro-life and, quote, pro-death penalty? Well, when you pop the hood and look under the covers, if you will, you'll find that the common thread isn't reverence for life and hatred of murderers. It's that they're pro-punishment. And when you look at it that way, it makes perfect sense. Have sex when you shouldn't, bad for you. Your punishment is that you must have the baby. Kill someone, you're going to be punished by being put to death. And so in one respect, there is some, how do you explain it? Well, if the common thread is to ensure that the American people hate government,
okay, let me
small, left, right, up, down, local, state, federal, it makes no difference. If the goal is to get people to hate government so that they can pass these kind of laws, there is a certain consistency there.
Okay, let me ask Diana the same thing. Diana, is it small government they want, or is it just total control that they want? What do you think?
Well, those are basically talking points, you know. And when it comes to women's reproductive rights, I mean, we're going beyond abortion at this point. Now we're trying to control the use of birth control pills. The supposed morning after pill, which is not an abortion bill, like RU486, which will cause that, the morning after pill is always conflated and confused with the RU486 pill, and you know they think that's an abortion bill. So, but it's an interesting conundrum here because they love the fetus, they hate the child. If you have a mom who's single, or you know, women have abortions for all kinds of a whole host of reasons. When you look at a mom with who has a termination because she's not financially able to take care of the child or whatever, they don't want to give her any type of support mechanism like housing, food stamps, welfare. You know, so you love the fetus, you hate the child. It's really becoming, and quite honestly, the abortion and reproductive rights thing is really more of a fundraising issue. The Republicans need it because as soon as they want to go out and raise money, it's like, oh, abortion, 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 send us $5, send us $10, whatever it is. You know, it seems to me that the quote-unquote big government mantra is just talking points. They don't mean it. I mean, the fact of the matter is, back when Bush was in office, if they really wanted to get rid of abortion, they had the House, the Senate, the judiciary, and the executive. They could have done it. They could have done it over the years, periods that they had it, but they didn't do it. Why? It's a great fundraiser. So I don't really think big government, I think it's just talk. It's not meaningful. It's just a talking point.
Thank you. Let me go on to Curtis. Curtis, you know, you've got tea parties all around you. You're a Democrat in what might be charitably called a magenta county.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
My sympathies to you. I'm very glad I'm in Palm Beach County.
Yeah, exactly. I wish I was there.
We're blue, man.
How do you deal with this hypocrisy? How do you deal with people who will tell you on the one hand they're pro-life, but they're pro-war? They're against government, but they want to control government and schools from Tallahassee.
Yeah, I agree with Diana. I mean, these are all just talking points to raise money. The goal is for them to win primaries, so they have to try and drum up their base, which is this whole pro-life, you know, we can't have abortions under any circumstances whatsoever. It's absolutely ridiculous. They're trying to fundraise. They're trying to garner as many primary votes as they can, and that's why they lose general elections.
That's
right. You've seen it the last two times. So it's all just talking points. There's no real substance there until it comes to economics. Now, when it comes to economics, their number one goal is to raise profits for corporations. That's it. End of story. That is the goal. Number one, raise profits for corporations. However they have to do it, whether it's small government, big government, state government, federal government, local, it doesn't matter. That's all they want to do. So they'll pass through any bill they can to make sure that happens. That's it. Just like I said, with this trigger bill, the entire goal is to raise profits for corporations. Close down public schools, sell them to corporations, let them
privatize
make money
it.
Off the taxpayers, and privatize it. That's it.
It seems curious to me that on the one hand, we have impoverished schools. We've had impoverished schools because the resources were not set aside. And now the same thinking, if you can call it that, that has given us schools with these kind of economic pressures, they somehow feel that if they add the profit motive, more education will be taking place instead of what's more likely to happen with more skim off the top. There'll be less resources for students.
That's another thing.
It's union busting because what do unions do? Unions take profits away from the corporations.
That's correct.
That's exactly why they want to bust unions. They don't care whose back they have to break to do it.
Let me go back to Kit. All one
has to do is look at the privatization of the prison industry.
I was just going to say that.
Exactly.
The words right out of my mouth. Yep.
Exactly. I mean, there was a case, I think it was in Indiana, of a juvenile judge who consistently was sentencing young people to this particular prison.
Actually, that was Pennsylvania.
Okay. He owns stock in the company. You know, hello, here's a dime, buy a clue. You know, when you're going to have a conflict of interest like that and don't disclose it, you're going to have these types of things. And never forget, the purpose of this whole charter school business is to destroy public education because their friends can't make money off of that.
It's another avenue for these people to make money. It's an untapped resource that hasn't been tapped before. So, I mean, I hate to bring this up like this, but I'm a big baseball fan. Branch Rickey brought Jackie Robinson in not to break the color barrier, but because he knew he could get the talent that he needed out of the African-American pool and make his team better. That's exactly what the Republicans are trying to do. They're trying to get an untapped resource in which they can make a profit for corporations. And that's
and,
what they found.
Can see
education
this move
is that.
In the testing arena, when you look at the FCATs and all the standardized testing and all this curriculum that
they're
feeding
profit
these kids, it's all from these corporations. In fact, the younger Jeb Bush, the younger Bush brother, was in the testing sales business and the educational software business. And, you know, they had no problem taking, you know, the money from the taxpayers. And who knows, you know, how effective that stuff is. We obviously know that testing is not teaching. And that's really what's going on in the Florida educational system now is you're teaching to the test.
Let me go back to Kit just for a moment. Kit, now you're in Dade County, and Dade County's got another opportunity to invest in a sports arena. Dade County with more poor population than any other part of the state. Can you speak to that dialogue right now? Once again, another sports company is coming and saying, please build us the facility so that we can bring more money making for our pockets and let you pay for it. How is that sitting in the Dade County electorate?
Well, I mean, obviously, for obvious reasons, because basically we got hosed on the Marlins Stadium.
Yeah,
and,
we did.
The Marlins owner. I think the general feeling is that people are tired of handing out welfare checks to millionaires and that, you know, he has money to do the work himself. And, I mean, this is the feeling of the electorate. And I'm not sure what I haven't been following that because we've been so busy with our own issues. So
sure.
I'm not sure where that is in the legislature. But I think in general,
they've got a bill for
I mean,
that
I don't
right
know
now.
I don't know what its progress is. But our concern down here is that we really did get hosed on the Marlins Stadium. They promised jobs. They brought an out-of-town contractor to do most of the work. This is the same promises, jobs, jobs, jobs. We have no idea what these jobs are going to be. Are they going to be minimum wage jobs? Are they going to be good jobs? Are they going to be union jobs? And that's really important to us.
Not to mention there's two charming basketball facilities they built downtown. Okay.
And the only reason they're not saying anything about that because that's a winning team. So.
Well, and the reality is, in fact, there's a bill right now, SB 358, that is going to in the Senate right now that is pretty much flying through the committee so far that I can see, which is not only expanding professional sports franchises in Florida, they are adding a Major League Soccer team to this bill. So we're just going to be continuing to fund additional sports. And, you know, now they're going to be giving funding to the Dolphins to rebuild that stadium in this bill. So, I mean, taxpayer-funded arenas. And, in fact, we were watching a Marlins game. We're big baseball fans in this house, and we're Marlins fans. We were watching a game this afternoon, and the empty seats were just incredible.
That's
exactly
right. Not to interrupt, but that was one of the things that they touted in this stadium was that they're going to be able to sell out the stadium, but they couldn't sell out Joe Robbie Stadium if they had a Super Bowl there. I mean, they could never get people to fill in the stadium when the Marlins are playing, and
well,
they still
can't. Well, when you put a stadium down in downtown Miami, I mean, they put it at the old Orange Bowl site. I mean, I grew up down here as a kid. I was 13 when I moved to Florida in 73. I used to go to Dolphins games down at the Orange Bowl, and we used to have to park on Jose's front lawn for $10 and hope that our
I went to a Dodger game last year, and that's exactly what we had to do. We had to park in some, like, parking lot, and like, a business parking lot. There's no parking there. It's
well,
a terrible
when you parked
place
on,
for a stadium.
When you parked on Jose's front lawn, 9 times out of 10, they let the guys block your car in, so you had to wait. You know, they built this monstrosity of a parking garage down there. It's very expensive. The average family cannot afford to go to the Marlins Stadium for a game, but by the time you pay for parking, by the time you pay for the seats, I mean, pretty much all the seats behind home plate were empty. And this is a Sunday afternoon, beautiful weather, you know. And when you throw it down in downtown Miami, you know, people from you know, North Broward certainly aren't going. Me in Palm Beach County, who would love to go to a game, I'm not schlepping down there.
I live in Indian River. I'm sure as hell not going.
Exactly. So I think the stadium was in the wrong location. I think it was way overpriced. The fact that they brought in outside, out-of-state labor, you know, all of those things, you know, all the promises of jobs and those kind of things, I've just not seen it pan out. And I don't think we're going to see it pan out when they give them the money for, the, you know, Joe Ravi or Dolphin Stadium or whatever the hell they're calling it this week, you know, either. And it's a shame considering that we're using tax dollars to fund these things.
I think what's very interesting, though, about the Marlins Stadium is that it could be used for concerts and
sure.
concerts that would appeal to locals. It has not been utilized that way.
That's
and that
right.
would at least help generate some revenues.
And offset some of those costs.
Right, exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me ask you this question. You know, we've clearly got a legislature with a tin ear, putting it gently. What do you think it's going to take to get their attention? Does it have to be a mass march on Tallahassee? Do we have to have sit-ins in their offices? What kind of suggestions do you have? And I'm going to reverse the order. I'm going to start with Curtis first. Curtis, what do you think it's going to take to finally get the attention of these people in Tallahassee to actually start responding to what their constituents actually need?
The ballot. You vote them out. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, we have a 17,000 voter deficit here. We have 43,000 Republicans. We have 20,000. So we just got new numbers in. So I guess a 15,000 deficit. 43,000 Republicans, 28,000 Democrats in this county. And, you know, our goal is to register voters and vote these guys out. We don't have a single local representative that's a Democrat. Out of our entire city council, our entire county commission, nobody's a Democrat. And our goal is to just vote these people out. Vote out the governor. Try and piggyback that election. Do whatever we can to get these guys out because they're not listening. They don't care. You can sit in their office. You can petition. You can call them. You can write letters. You can write emails. I hate to say it like this, but it feels like a waste of time. The only thing to do is vote these guys out and get someone in that's going to do the job. And the key for that for us in this county is voter registration. So that's
okay.
what we're doing. We're putting 100% of our resources into registering voters to get new representatives in office.
Okay, let me go to Diana now. Diana, what's your thoughts? I mean, obviously, you've been involved in the political process for a long time. You know Tallahassee. You know what it takes to get someone elected. Where do you think the pressure needs to be put next to turn this situation around?
I've always thought that the people need their own Alec. I mean, the reality is, when you have these lobbying groups, I mean, you and I don't have a lobbying group. Kit doesn't have a lobbying group. We don't have a lobbying group that's as powerful as, say, the AARP, which at this point is an insurance company anymore.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, when you look at Alec, this last meeting that they had in the annual conference was held in New Orleans. Out of 160 state legislators, 60 had ties with Alec since 2010. And it was the largest turnout of Florida legislators, and 99% of them, there's a couple of Democrats in there, right-leaning Democrats, but 99% of these guys that belong to Alex from the Florida legislature are Republicans. And they've set up a trust fund that has like $50,000 in it to allow these guys to attend these conferences at no cost. And again, because they're not a lobbying group, this doesn't fall under the gift category. We as Floridians, we as the people, you know, I appreciate going out and registering voters, but here's the reality, and I'll give you some sad statistics on voting. People don't show up. I mean, that's reality.
You're exactly right.
I just did six local municipal elections. West Palm Beach, which is our county seat, we have 47,000 registered voters. Most of them are Democrats. You had a 9% turnout. 9%.
Jeez.
And these are people that are in your local government that are going to decide how high your fence is, what kind of dogs you can have, what kind of trees you can have that are going to impact your local life. People don't show up. Registering is great. Getting out the vote is better.
No, you're exactly right. You do need to back that with some sort of legal reward program for voting. And that's something that we're working on in this county. And
well, you know, and,
it's something
and,
that I think
and the
work.
Reality is they're counting on you not showing up. They're counting
right. Well, no,
on
you're
that.
Right. You're right. I mean, in the state
you know,
of Florida, we do have a stronghold. We have more Democrats than Republicans registered in this state.
Yeah, by 550,000.
That's exactly
I mean,
right.
When you look at the Alex Sink election, the fact that she only lost by 60,000 votes in the state, and when you look at the turnout overall was 17% among Democrats. I mean, here in Palm Beach County, I don't have the total state count, but when you have a midterm turnout of 17%, that's where your issue is. That's why you can't get rid of these guys. And I think at some point the people need to band together to form their own Dan Alec or their own lobby because we don't have
Thank
a people's
you.
Lobby.
Let me go to Hans now. Hans, what do you think? Is there – we've heard a couple ideas here. What's your take? What do you think it's going to take to get this legislator to pay some attention to the public?
Well, it's going to – and I agree that it's just going to have to take defeats, major, major defeats. I'm reminded this would have been, I think, around 2010, I don't think even as late as 2011, the Republican caucus was already, the Florida House of Representatives Republican caucus was already committing their votes to the 2016-2017 Speaker of the House. Now,
yes.
you do that, why? Because you in your mind are assured that you're going to be in power forever, and that's going to be the attitude. That's going to, you know, they're going to govern from that position. It goes back to what Kit was saying at the beginning of the program. She called four times to set up an appointment to speak with her state representative. They don't care. There's no, and it's what I said. There's no consequence for their actions. And what makes it worse, that coming back to that 9% turnout, is that the people don't see either that they can have an effect, or they've got the shade pulled over their eyes by feeling that, well, my representative's against abortion, so that's why I'm always going to vote for him. Meanwhile, he's decimating your schools, he's decimating your environment, he's decimating your drinking water. But even there, it's not. But for 10 or 20 years before that person looks around and says, our water's poisoned. Why doesn't somebody do something about that? There's no direct line. And I hate to be pessimistic on that, but, you know, our five-minute attention span with our 458 channels on TV and our little echo chambers to repeat what we already believe, until our legislators are defeated and that the Republicans are back in the minority, we're just not going to really stand a chance of making any sort of changes.
I agree with that.
Okay,
obviously,
Kit,
I do too.
Kit, what
sadly,
do you think?
I agree with that. I wish it wasn't true, but sadly, I agree with that.
Kit, what do you think?
Well, I think one of the worst things that ever happened in Tallahassee was term limits, because now these people are at the beck and call of whoever the current leadership is to move up into leadership in a limited amount of time. So they don't care about their constituents. They care about more power in the legislature. That is, and it destroyed any sort of collegiality that was ever there in the Florida legislature to begin with. But aside from that, I'm not as pessimistic as folks. I think it takes a level of education. We do a lot of grassroots leadership development in both languages, Spanish and English, and people don't understand the layers of government and who does what at what level. And once they have an understanding and they're engaged in it, then they feel like they can get out and vote and make a difference. They do not really, honestly, they do not understand people that have been born and raised here, whether it's taking civics out of schools or whatever it is, they do not understand what a county does, what a city does, what a state legislature does, and what the federal government does. And
I agree
with that. We focus a lot on that type of education to engage people at the grassroots.
And one other thing that I remember there was an interview after he left the House with Peter Rudy Wallace, who is one of the last Democratic speakers of the House. And he said the one thing that he regretted the most was he had the opportunity to implement some nonpartisan redistricting mechanism in the state of Florida. But unfortunately, he had that same amount of hubris that the GOP has today. The Democrats had always been in power, they'll always be in power. Well, within a few years, the GOP was in charge of the Florida House, and they've never had to look back. I'm not saying that nonpartisan redistricting is a panacea, but at least it gets away from the most egregious examples of gerrymandering, and at least we can move towards where the people. I mean, look at this last election, 2012, not 6 months ago. The Democrats nationwide got a million more votes for their House of Representatives, the congresspersons, than the GOP did. And yet, the GOP only lost a scattering of seats.
That's
wrong.
Right.
And it's wrong because of the redistricting. I must tell you, I've enjoyed tonight's conversation. I must, unfortunately, beg off, but enjoyed it. And Rick, I look forward to my next invitation.
Thank you so much, Hans. The rest of you stick around a minute. I want to raise another issue. There was a very informative article in the Palm Beach Post today. I don't know if many of you had a chance to see it. It's entitled Links to Lawmakers and Edge for Charters. And what it does is it talks about how many key legislators are either directly or by marriage related to businesses that are benefiting from the charter decisions they've just made. I'm just going to read just a little bit of it and then get your opinion. Tallahassee, after spending heavily on ruling Republicans last election, charter schools and online education companies are poised to gain a major push forward this spring from the legislature. Both financial and family bonds that link top GOP lawmakers to this rapidly growing industry have given it an outsized advantage. Who would have guessed? Political and corporate intrigue. And this shift has renewed calls for a stricter ethical standard in Tallahassee. Well, that'll happen quickly. The charter and virtual school lobby thinks it's taken control of this legislature, and they're getting plenty of help from some members to do this, said Andy Ford, president of the Florida Educational Association, the state's largest teachers union. Companies and political committees promoting alternatives to traditional public schools poured more than $2 million into Florida campaigns, mostly to GOP.
Well, I'll tell you something. I hate to call out one of my own here, but here in Palm Beach County and throughout the state, you have the vice president's brother, who is the largest pusher. His company, and the name escapes me at the moment, but he is a chieftain of one of the largest charter school companies that is pushing charter schools here in the state of Florida. It comes down to a money issue, and again, a lot of this is backed by ALEC legislation. They're one of the biggest pushers of privatizing education, privatizing prisons. But when you talk about charter schools, Joe Biden's brother is down here in Florida pushing charter schools and is lobbying the legislature very, very hard to privatize education. So, we have that going on both sides.
Well, maybe this is a sideline for former president's relatives. We've got Jeb Bush pushing it, and we've got Mr. Biden's brother pushing it. Makes for interesting bedfellows, doesn't it?
It's sad.
When we were going to school, I think many of you are roughly the same age I am. When we were going to school, there was an expression that teaching to the test was a bad thing.
Yes.
And yet we find today that basically that's all that's being done, teaching to these tests.
Well, that happened originally under Jeb Bush's A-plus plan, as well as the No Child Left Behind Act, which was kind of a hysterical thing, because when you looked at the quote-unquote grades of schools under the A-plus Florida plan that Jeb Bush put forward, you'd have schools being A's and B's, but yet under No Child Left Behind, they were F's. And so the standardization really wasn't a standardization at all, because you had a national standardized test, and then you had the FCAT here in Florida. And those two things seemed to be in conflict, and so they kind of jimmied the numbers around so they would, you know, come together. But again, you know, Jeb Bush and his younger brother got pushed, you know, pushed these privatized tests because that's what they sold. And so it's really about business, and it's not about education by any means.
Not to try and throw out Richard's age at all, but I did actually take the FCAT when I was a student, and you're exactly right. It taught to the test. That's exactly what it did. And for the FCAT writing, that's exactly what we did. For 18 weeks out of the year, we learned how to write a 5-paragraph sentence, and that's all that mattered. Write a 5-paragraph sentence, and we did that every day, day in and day out, for 18 weeks, for two semesters, and it was terrible. It was absolutely atrocious. Didn't teach me anything. It didn't teach me a single thing in writing. I don't write in a 5-paragraph sentence anymore. I mean, nobody does that. That's not common day real world skills, right? But once again, that brings me back to my original point when I first got on the air, was with the Common Core standards. Those don't teach to the test. Those are just a curriculum that you have to follow. And our county seems to want to go on the reverse route, just like this entire program is premised on, and make it a bigger deal. Make it, you know, teach to the test, not to curriculum or not to real-world issues or anything like that. And it's complete hypocrisy. It's unbelievable that this is what they're saying.
Well, you know, Rick, I'd like to go back to something that Kit said earlier when he was talking about the term limits.
Sure.
I went up to Tallahassee for Palm Beach County Lobby Days in the middle of March, and what struck me as I was up there is that because of these term limits, these kids that are coming in, and they're kids, they're young enough to be my kids. They're in their late 20s, mid-20s, early 30s, that are now legislators. Most of them, of course, are Republicans, as you well know. They don't read the damn bills. They don't read them because basically leadership comes to them and say they're the head of a committee, transportation committee, some committee. Look, this bill's coming in your committee. You better vote up on it. And these kids are kids. They've never been in government before. They were put up by their local parties, and they won because of, obviously, the gerrymandering that goes on, you know, in other parts of the state. But these kids are so young. They don't even understand what the hell they're reading, and they don't read it at all. They're just told by leadership, you will vote up on this bill. And if you don't vote up on this bill, you're going to lose your committee. You're going to be bounced. We're going to primary you. And that's the biggest fear they all have, is that if
that's
you don't...
That's exactly right. Republicans' biggest fear anyway in this area is
primary.
You're exactly right.
And so there is no legislation going on because leadership basically says to these young kids who are wet behind the ears, who wouldn't know a bill from their, you know, their iPod player, this is how you're going to vote on this bill. It's coming before your committee, and Mr. Speaker wants you to vote on this. And they're going to vote the way they're told. And this is what happens. Otherwise, you will be primaried and you'll be bounced out of office. So it really becomes, because of term limits, you know, Susan Booker, who I am very good friends with, who was the aide to Ed Healey, told me that when she was up there in the legislature as an aide to Ed Healey, it didn't work like this. You know, there was camaraderie. There was bipartisanship. Even with Republicans, even with the Democrats being in majority, they work together to do good stuff for people. Those days are gone, and term limits didn't help it at all.
Well, as we come along the roundup for this evening, let me ask you to give us one thought of yours as to how we can either begin to turn this around or make some kind of dent, whether it be opposing term limits or getting out the vote or education. I'm a big fan of education. I think that one of the benefits of taking it to the street and showing up at their offices is that people do hear about that when these confrontations happen. There is a teachable moment, as the old saying goes. So let me start with you, Kit. Your final thoughts on this evening's discussion. What strategies are you going to be adopting for the months ahead?
South Florida Jobs with Justice has always done the same thing. We believe in grassroots activism, and we believe in involving people in actions, getting press, and that absolutely, once it's in the news, that it becomes something that people see, whether it's on Spanish television or on Spanish radio or Haitian Creole radio. All of that is really important. It has to be a part of the education of citizens and what people are doing in a place that is a 9-hour drive away.
Thank you so much, Kit. Really appreciate your efforts. Diana, your thoughts?
Well, you know, one of the things, and thinking about voter registration, here in Palm Beach County, Susan Booker registers about 100 new citizens a week.
Wow.
And most of them are of Hispanic origin, whether it's Cuban or South American or whatever it is. Most of them are Hispanic. They don't understand our political system. And so when she says, how do you want to register? They go, well, what's my choices? And they go, Democrat, Republican, MPA. Well, I don't know what to do, so just put me in as an MPA. If you look at the new registration statistics, and if you want low-hanging fruit, Hispanics are low-hanging fruit because they don't understand what our political system is. What does it mean to be a Democrat? What does it mean to be a Republican? And one of the programs that the Palm Beach County Democratic Party is going to be doing is they're going to be looking at and getting the data from Susan Booker's office every week of who registered new. And if they registered MPA, we got to flip them, and we got to make them understand how important it is to vote. And getting people out of office that are bad people is the way to do this. And registering is great, but getting them to the polls and enticing these people to the polls. You know, I live in a very rural community in western Palm Beach County, and I have 1,500 people in my precinct. In my primary in 2012, my August primary, where we're deciding on state legislators and, you know, constitutional officers and those kinds of things, out of 1,500 people in the primary, 37 people showed up to vote, two of which were me and my husband. So how sad is that? You know, I mean, so getting out the vote, I think, is and how to drive that, and whether it's rides to the polls or picking up absentee ballots on behalf of folks, or, you know, having a barbecue after you know, before you vote, or gathering people, groups of people, getting groups of people to the polls who normally would not vote. The problem with our political system when it comes to campaign is that we consultants generally look at those who showed up for the past two or three elections, and everybody else is ignored. We don't target those guys. You know, target the guy that came out for one or two elections. Maybe reengage him. Because those people can be low-hanging fruit. They're already registered. They showed up for a couple elections. Maybe get them to come out for a municipal or a midterm. You know, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there that we're ignoring as far as getting out the vote. And getting out the vote, to me, would be a huge, huge thing to do.
Thank you, Diana. And now, Curtis, as we round up the afternoon, go ahead.
I agree with Diana. My background is with Organizing for America. That's where I started getting into the political process back in 2008. And their biggest thing is analytics. So I've done I've done extensive research on voting as a habit. And believe it or not, voting is a habit. And to answer Diana's question, the reason why we focus on people that have voted the last two or three times is because voting is a habit. The more you vote, the more you're going to vote. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I agree with Diana once again that we need to make sure these people that are that are registering to vote are registering as Democrats. Either they switch their party affiliation from MPA to Democrats, or they register originally as Democrats. And then we have to get them to the polls because voting is a habit. That's the only
and
way
getting
we're
them
gonna
into
win
that
it.
Habit is the key.
Getting them into that habit, right. And like I said before, when we're doing our voter registration drives, we have plans on legally rewarding people for voting. And that's exactly right, doing barbecues, doing concerts, doing things like that around election time, around polling places to try and attract registered voters to come to that area. That's the way you do it. That's the way you do it. I mean, you have to vote these people out. My entire mantra this entire conversation has been, these Republicans do not care. You can talk to them until you're blue in the face. You can ask them. You can come up with meetings. My yep. U.S. congressman here is Bill Posey. I have a friend of mine that's running against him, Corey Westbrook, and she asked me, she's a big environmentalist. She worked with Oceana. I mean, she's going to be a great congresswoman when she beats him. And she asked me, how do I take the environment and make it a voter issue? And the next thing you have to do is make it economics. So we have to educate the voters on how the Republicans are killing the economy here. And with the environment in Indian River County, we have the Indian River Lagoon, which is the most diverse body of water in the world. We have more species in the Indian River Lagoon than any other body of water in the world. And it's dying. Our seagrass is absolutely getting killed every day. I mean, the seagrass is just dying. So we're talking about ways to tie that into the economy. And I explained to her that once we do that, then you start gaining votes. Then people start listening. You mean my real estate property taxes are going to go down? What do you mean? You know, because nobody wants to live on a dying lagoon. So you talk about things like that. So education is secondary to voter registration and to voting these people out. But I cannot overstate how important voter registration is and getting the people to the polls, just like Diana said.
Well, thank you all so much. I sure appreciate it.
Before I go, if I I could suggest a website for people to take a look at how bad this situation is go,
go
to
ahead,
www.alecexposed.org. That's A-L-E-C, exposed.org. And you can see state to state. You can see their model legislation, what they're pushing on all these different states, right to work, consumer, tort reform, privatizing schools, privatizing healthcare, you know, environment. These guys are hitting us on all fronts. And I think it's very important that people understand what this organization is and how it's affecting you. On the good side, 50 companies have left and disassociated themselves with ALEC because they're getting so they're getting more high, exposure. They used to be very secretive, and they're not anymore because Facebook and social media has helped us expose them more. But go to alecexposed.com, learn what's happening in your territory.
Well, thank you very much, Diana. Thank you, Curtis. And thank you, Kit. I really appreciate you joining us and sharing your insights into this current, let's be generous, non-responsive to their constituents' legislature. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Okay. Next up, we've got an interview with Representative Mark Pafford, who's going to give us his take on the Tallahassee two-step. So here we go with Representative Mark Pafford.
Over at the Village Inn, and there was a woman there by the name of Samantha, and Samantha was closing her section of the restaurant. She saw me, my tie was loosened, still wearing my jacket, I had my member pin, and she said, "Are you a legislator?" And I said, "Yes, I am a legislator." And she says, "I'd like to talk to you." And we spent about 30 minutes talking. She immediately told me that her job as a server at the Village Inn supplemented her state job that she's been in for 26 years. She went on to tell me that she was concerned. Why? Well, let me tell you about Samantha. She's divorced. She has a four-year degree from FSU, 1985, in risk management and insurance. Not only did she work at the Village Inn, she works at the Civic Center when she can get an opportunity to work. And she also works for the Florida Department of Financial Services. She's a smart person. 26 years for the state of Florida, she nets $2,500 a month. $2,500 a month. 26 years with the state of Florida, she's supplementing her income. How dare we consider lessening what we do to our public servants? $900 for her house payment, $300 for her car payment, because her 18-year-old car died. She had to go get a car. May I go on, Mr. Speaker? 18 months behind her mortgage with a bank that doesn't care too much. Yeah, it upset me. I got dinner down, but it took a while. She's got a 25-year-old daughter who's in school at FSU. She's working. Thank goodness her father has insurance because the new federal law allows her to be part of that health insurance. And thank goodness it's a part-time.
That was a brief statement taken from Representative Pafford's comments on the floor of the legislature. And now the interview with Mr. Pafford. That was such a great, spirited defense of the civil servants we have here in the state of Florida. And now the interview. An exemplary progressive leader. He has been very good about keeping Florida activists involved and informed of what's going on in Tallahassee. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me bring on the good representative, Mark Pafford. Representative Pafford, how are you today, sir?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you. I got in. I drove through the night to get the heck out of there, and got home at around 4 a.m. or so. So I am in the office on a landline because most of my interviews with you are horrific because of my cell phone. So I figured the least I could do is drive in and have a decent interview.
Well, sir, you are very kind. And more important than that, you are doing such a great job, not just in the legislative work that you're doing, sir, but to keep us all informed. For that, we owe you a double debt of thanks. Thank you again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. You know, the more you guys know about before I do something, makes me feel more confident that what I'm doing is okay. So, you know, it goes both ways. The fact that you know what I'm doing and the fact that everybody seems to comment and provide input. You know, it's a very lonely place to be sometimes, and it helps to know that my base at home, you know, the folks that actually put me in this seat, care. So thank you.
Well, we do, sir, and believe me, the fact that you keep us abreast of these incredible goings on up there. You know, there's so much horrific stuff you have been wading through. Most of us caught that great comment you made about the school. I cannot call it a trigger bill because it's basically a theft bill. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that, the bill to authorize the corporatization of Florida schools?
Yeah, and to kind of thinly, you know, veil the idea as, you know, parent empowerment. You know, it's all hogwash, and it's you know what it's come to in the state of Florida is a state who's been run by the Republican Party, and you know, I'm sure historically they've done some good things, but boy, you know, you take major issues like public education, which is provided for in the state constitution, and to have a bill that basically redirects our attention for another year to the private sector and to, you know, private dollars. And in fact, what was amazing in the debate was some of the proponents were actually openly saying, look, you know, this is about the private sector. This is about the free market. This is, you know, it's actually quite shocking. I'm sure you're not the only one picking it up, but I have a feeling that the statewide press will be doing the same.
Let's hope so. You know,
yeah.
The fact that they want to turn education into a money-making effort so that funds can be drawn off for profit, that they want to do the same thing with the prison system, when they refuse to adequately fund it, but yet they have no problem spending money to hand over to corporate interests.
Right. And you know, look, what's the root cause of everything that we talk about in terms of privatization and turning schools over to the private sector and on and on and on? It's because we refuse to do things like look for, you know, enhanced revenue to the state budget. You, we still don't have a millionaire's tax in the state. Some people want to call it an intangibles tax. It's a millionaire's tax. We still don't have any discussions about corporate taxes other than, you know, moving from number 5 to number 4 or 3 in terms of, you know, states with the least amount of burden on corporations. We're number 5. That's pretty good. You would think that would incentivize all these jobs, you know, our wonderful governor's talking about. It's nonsense. And frankly, at the end of the day, I have to say, 4 years under my belt and a fifth halfway there, you know, the primary goal of the legislative majority is to continue to give gifts away so they can continue to get elected, and they use that trough of cash to do it. And, you know, there's no gun bills that make any sense. Well, I think there might be the mental health bill, but, you know, they selected that very, very carefully, and I don't know why yet. You know, the major things that are going on in society we don't address. And then, you know, they accuse Democrats of, you know, basically turning their backs on a budget. Well, you know, I'm not the type of person to trade or throw my vote to a budget that spends more money without having a discussion about the budget. You know, they seem to think that if there's more money in the budget, then everybody should be happy. And there's a basic understanding that's not there on their part. Nobody's ever come to me and said, why do you have a problem with the budget? You know, my answer would be, well, because we don't really have a budget process. We spend money that we're given by you, and that money's, you know, found behind some closed door, quite literally, with the speaker and maybe the chair of the Appropriations Committee, but nobody knows who's behind that door. And year after year, it's the same. So you've got a city like Haverhill in my district that spends probably 6 to 8 months putting together a $1 million budget, and you got a state of Florida that puts a $74 billion budget in less than 45 days. There's some major, major flaws with what we're doing up there.
Another one of the interesting legislative activities that we are concerned about these days is that charming anti-sick leave, anti-living wage legislation. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. For a state of Florida that, you know, loves local control, don't forget, you know, we've done incredible things in the state. I say we, I get in trouble. Like, for instance, you know, having no Department of Community Affairs anymore. When it comes to
regulation? Are you saying regulation?
Exactly. You know, we don't want that. But you know what? We definitely want to tell our cities how to spend dollars and it's just nonsense. And listen, I mean, this obviously was motivated by an issue in Orange County that basically motivated the majority leader, you know, Representative Precourt, to deliver a kill shot. And that's pretty much what happened yesterday.
Well, you know, it's not just Orange County. Dade County has some ordinances as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
so does Palm Beach County.
It puts to lie that Republican sloganeering that talks about local control, local governments, no one solution, not government from above and afar. It absolutely puts a complete lie to that. And
well, I mean, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is the Soviet bloc. I didn't debate on that largely because they probably would have kicked me out. But you know, I gave my talking points to several other members, and they kind of did that. But that's where I was going to go. They may have shut down my microphone at that point. But look, it's, you know, in this particular instance, it's very, very top down, and it flies in the face of, you know, local control. It flies in the face of, you know, Miami Beach being different than Tallahassee, or Miami being different than Alachua. And it's everything that's wrong about an ability of a local government to spend their local dollars the way they feel fit. It's everything against providing basic wages to keep people out of poverty, which keeps people off our Medicaid rolls. You can go on and on and on. This was, you know, a bill that was purely politically motivated to resolve an issue in Orange County because some people know somebody and they got cranky.
Well, you know, it seems to me that we need to unmask some of these villains. You know, when these powerful interests write the check to these ALEC-inspired legislators to do their bidding, you know, my gosh, where does any respect for a living wage go when you're throwing out living wage rights? Minimum sick leave benefits. No one would ever accuse Florida of being too generous to its employees. And to see that whittled away when there are some small institutions that want to try to do better, if Republican policies are so incredibly effective for business, where's the results of these years of Republican governance?
Right. Well, and, you know, unfortunately, that's what's right in front of us. You know, we've got a state of Florida that ranks so often in the upper 40s as compared to other states in so many categories, other than, you know, the one I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, where we're ranked number 5, I think, in terms of the burden on corporate taxes, you know, which is wonderful. You know, that's Rick Scott's attempt to have fun with Rick Perry on Texas. You know, it's nonsense, but that's what we have right now. And we've got to concentrate on, you know, getting a Democratic governor elected.
Now, there were some flickers in the press, but not much coverage at all, about the new improved election system that's going to come from this legislature. Is that something you can talk about?
Yeah, you know, I think the House passed out a budget with a lot of very, very good, beneficial items in the elections bill, but it didn't go far enough. We were hoping the Senate, you know, will be able to tack on some things, and that may occur. And if it comes back to the House and it's less than, you know, what we think it should contain, then obviously we're going to have to go back to the drawing board and see what else we can get in there. You know, there's the portability issue. There is the witness now, I think, on these absentee ballots. There's a number of things that are really, really bad with the bill. You know, there's one issue about electronic poll books. Right now, you know, the Republicans claim that this whole idea of reforming the election code was because of fraud. And as I've said before, there's probably more UFOs that are spotted in the state than actual cases of fraud. And yet, they, for $22 million, they could provide electronic poll books to the supervisors of election to basically find out immediately if you voted across the street, you know, 2 minutes ago. But they refuse to do that because, you know, they need a boogeyman. And so, you know, it's a lot of rhetoric. Hopefully what you know, we can get out of the legislature will be an improvement, but they certainly don't have to do that. And so, you know, there's this balance. We'll have to see what happens.
Well, Mr. Pafford, sir, your work as a representative of the good people of this area is demonstrably remarkable in the face of the odds you've got there. And I want to thank you. Is there any other thing you would like people to know about this godforsaken legislature before we...
Look, there is good news. You know, we only have about 4 weeks left. So, you know, I mean, the last day of session, actually, you know, when we sine die, which is, you know, the term they use for ending and shutting down session, you know, it's usually it's the most dangerous day, but it's the brightest day because we don't have a chance to tamper with anything after that. You know, let's cross our fingers on Medicaid reform. Let's hope, you know, we do something with that. Maybe that's another show. There's still 4 weeks, but, you know, we're kind of digging in here on that issue amongst several that I've mentioned earlier and really kind of handing it to them and saying, look, folks, this is your baby. You've blown it for, you know, well over a dozen years now, and what do you have to say for yourself? So we'll see what happens.
Do you think, one last question if you don't mind, with Governor nearly convicted Scott, with him trying to prepare himself for another election run, is there some hope in that we won't see the worst part of the fangs of the Republican Party simply because he's going to try to moderate a little bit to look more electable?
Yeah, I can see him pulling a Charlie Crist and basically saying, you know, look, I can't hurt the teachers. I can't hurt the parents. You know, let's go ahead and let's veto the parent trigger, you know. And that would be fascinating because... in order to do an override, the Republicans would need us now, and you know, I think we would lock down procedurally, and they'd be unable to override the governor. So, you know, it's going to be fascinating to see how this moves forward. You know, they don't have the advantages they had last year at this time, and so they've got to be very, very careful to do things that allow them to save face, but also, you know, continue the turmoil that they're basically beginning to outwardly display when it comes to the Senate president, the speaker, and the governor not agreeing on everything, which to me is, you know, just wonderful.
Saving grace. Thank you again, sir. Representative
sure.
Mark Pafford, District 86. Thank you again, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Well, that was Representative Mark Pafford giving us his appraisal of the legislative session so far. As he said, hope remains. There's only 4 weeks left. How much more damage can they do? But we'll see. Now I'd like to bring on a very special guest, an author, and also a former Wall Street analyst. Her name is Renee Schacher, and her book is called Confessions of an Ex-Reaganite. Renee, welcome.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, you know, I just caught the tail end there, and that's pretty sad commentary when the best thing we can hope for is that the legislative session is going to end in 4 weeks. But that was good.
You know, and he speaks as a person who's been there, they're working on his fifth year. I have to salute him. You know, he's still got a pretty positive attitude considering the kind of madness that he has to deal with up there.
Yes.
But, Renee, I've invited you on to talk about a different kind of mental attitude, the attitude of Wall Street, the attitude that you've written about so cogently in your book. You talk about your perspective coming from a conservative, coming from a financial analyst point of view, and looking, you know, kind of you've done a wonderful job with an overview of how things have evolved from those days. And I was wondering, I asked you to talk a little bit about your book today and also a little bit about what we've seen recently in the revolving door at the SEC. So, Renee, I'm going to hand it over to you and go ahead, tell us a little bit of a story.
Okay. Well, you know, I've been doing a little research for the book on this whole issue of the revolving door. And there is a wonderful group out there called the Center for Responsive Politics, and they maintain an absolutely amazing record of everything that has to do with money and Congress and federal elections, breaking down spending by lobbying group, spending by election, you know, all the PACs, the super PACs, you know, the non-disclosed donors and so forth. Anyhow, they've also done a little bit of research on this whole issue of the revolving door, and I found some really interesting statistics. Now, when you say revolving door, you have to define that as being people who were within government, specifically the congressional staffers, if not the Congress members themselves, who have gone into industry lobbying, and then the other way around, industry lobbyists slash employees who have gone into government at the congressional level, specifically as a staffer. And when you add up all those people right now, there are about 2,700 who you can consider revolving door personnel. And to put that in perspective, we have a total of 538 elected representatives. And when you take their professional staff and you exclude the secretaries and the janitors and all the other support positions, there's only about 2,800 people. So, you know, it looks as if we've got a one-to-one ratio, and that's a little misleading. Again, because this also represents people who have gone from government into private industry. So it's, but nevertheless, it does paint a really interesting picture as to how much government has been infiltrated, if you will, by private industry, and how many in private industry are come from Washington. Now, you know, going from Washington to private industry is a pretty simplistic formula. You know, it's money, pure and simple. I mean, the salaries that the lobbyists are offered, you know, to bring that governmental expertise to work for private industry is substantial and significantly beyond what anybody could earn working for the government. The other side is superficially, just as simplistic, but a little bit more complex, but basically has to do with government, or I'm sorry, industry is wanting to get into government to write the laws. Obviously, our Congress is not endowed with the level of detailed knowledge of every subject under the sun to be able to tackle this without the aid of lobbyists and as well as their staffers. And, you know, what better way to influence the outcome of any legislation than by putting your own people in place to do the writing?
Sure.
And that's, you know, basically the reason that happens. But what's really interesting is when you look at the committees, the congressional committees, that have the most number of revolving door personnel, by far the largest is energy and commerce. And, you know, that's kind of a no-brainer, you know, because that covers the oil industry and the coal industry, you know, all the Koch brother interests. And then, and that's in the House. On the Senate side, the largest is the Finance Committee. And then underneath that, you've got Ways and Means and Appropriation. Of course, Ways and Means is our tax code, and Appropriations is how the government's money gets spent. And then we go down from there. You know, the numbers drop down significantly, but there are, in both the House and the Senate, you know, probably upwards of, 15 to 20 congressional committees that do have members of the industry sitting and writing the laws. Now, you mentioned specifically the SEC and the finance industry, and like this whole phenomenon of the revolving door, it all comes down to money. And I'm going to digress here for just a moment. I found this incredibly fascinating, very detailed and very exhaustive research report done by a scientific journal called Tobacco Control, which sounds way off the mark here. But the research that was done draws all the lines with the 8x10 glossies and circles and arrows from the tobacco industry back down to today's Tea Party, and how the Tea Party basically got its start. The genesis of the Tea Party was the Koch brothers, who founded a group called CSC, Citizens for a Sound Economy, very benign-sounding name. And the purpose of this group, which was a combination of PACs and 501c3s and 501c4s and 527s and state-level PAC, it's a complex legal structure, but basically it's a conduit for collecting money that at the time whose purpose was to fight the anti-smoking regulations that were coming down and other air pollution in general. And it's a fascinating article, and, you know, I would encourage anybody, you can look it up on the website. It's very easy to find. But it draws the lines all the way down to what is today's Tea Party. Now, I mention the story because this is the beginning of big money in government. I mean, you know, money has always been the rocket fuel behind elections. But during this time frame, and we're talking the late 90s, early 2000 period, there were loopholes in the federal elections laws that industry started to take advantage of. And, of course, the pioneers in this area being the Koch brothers and everybody from Karl Rove to Grover Norquist, you know, eventually got in on the game. And what this did is this created these huge, huge, huge pools of money that were put together for the purpose of generally anti-government, pro-business agenda, and specifically getting people on the congressional committees to write the legislation that would affect their industries. And, you know, from that, of course, as they say, the rest is history. When we had Citizens United, which opened up the coffers of corporate treasuries even more so. So, you know, that, by way, is a background of how this whole process got started and how it started to kick in a really, really big way. Now, coming back to the SEC and the finance industry, of course, you know, the SEC goes way back in time to 1933 is when it was founded in the wake of the post-Depression era, where we separated banking into the very humdrum, boring commercial banking, which is taking deposits and making loans, and the much more exciting and the infinitely sexier part of finance, which is underwriting securities and stocks and bonds and investments and IPOs and, you know, like I said, all that really sexy stuff. And it was starting in the Reagan administration and then gathered steam since then to take down Glass-Steagall, which was finally dismantled under Clinton. And then we went into the Bush era, where it was an era of basically anything goes for the finance industry going forward. So you had the confluence of two events happening simultaneously. You had the deregulation of the banking industry, and you had campaign finance and political contributions turning into ultra big money. And those two factors came together. And of course, the SEC and all this hadn't really changed much over the years. It was a pretty stodgy, pretty conservative, but yet historically fairly effective organization for keeping Wall Street in line until this new era. This new era of big money and this new era of no-holds-barred banking. And then what you also had occurring at the time is, and again, this goes back to Reagan, but was perfected with extraordinary skill under the Bush administration, is this whole anti-government movement and what you could call the starve-the-beast strategy. If you can't get rid of government agencies that you don't like, well, the next best thing is to strangle them. And, again, coming back to, you know, this era of big money influencing government, and especially under the Bush administration, you had the beginning of this whole shackling of agencies, you know, things like you would, you know, they would get Congress to starve funding for them. They would hold up appointments to head the agencies. They would tie the agencies up in endless legal battles to, and basically do whatever they can to render these agencies completely ineffective, short of abolishing them. And that's what happened to the SEC. The SEC was starved for money. Its leadership was lackluster, and that's being generous. And so at a time when Wall Street was running wild, so to speak, I mean, the whole area of global finance was expanding exponentially. You had a new era in financial engineering, financial products, new products coming out, you know, going back to some of the things that we talked about in the last show that you had me on. And the SEC couldn't keep up. It had neither the funding to hire the people. It did not have the funding to employ the researchers to look into these new products, these derivatives and securitizations and all these other fancy things that were being developed. It didn't have the money to invest in technology, whereas, you know, Wall Street is an industry that thrived on technology as well as a lot of brain power, you know, with computer-assisted trading, very, very sophisticated pricing models, And, you know, basically the SEC was still in the era of, you know, green eye shades and number two pencils in the back of the closet. And then Dodd-Frank came along and created a new crisis, if you will, for the banking industry. For those of you who are not familiar, Dodd-Frank was the fiercely fought legislation that came after the implosion of our economy starting in 2008, which nearly, you know, brought down the economy and nearly destroyed our banking system in the process. And recognizing the damage that was done and taking down Glass-Steagall and all the other safeguards that our society and our economy had for, you know, 50-plus years, and plus the public outcry, Congress decided to take up legislation to rein in some of these excesses. And it was a very complex and a very, very complicated piece of legislation. It's still not finished. Much of it is still in the rules writing stage. A lot of it was knocked out by the very powerful banking industry, who got a lot of the provisions that it found most unlivable, got those knocked out. But there was a lot that still remained. And, again, it went, a lot of it went into the rules writing stage. And so this is where the lobbyists step in and, with a smile, are only too happy to assist in writing those rules, of course, to their advantage. So the SEC is, its history was as a very worthwhile, a very effective, and a very noble enterprise within our socioeconomic system of banking that is, you know, is the engine that drives our economy. And then starting in the late 90s and after the turn of the century when banking started to change, the SEC started becoming more and more ineffective too. What we have now is kind of a sad case. I know that there are efforts to beef up the SEC, but we're still in that battle of industry fighting government in general and agencies in particular and laws, even down to, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's.
Well, if I may interrupt for just a moment, you know, the Mary Jo White appointment was quite controversial. And I was just looking at this an article that mentions that many of the president's advisors hail from the upper echelons of Goldman Sachs. He mentions Jack Lew, Treasury Secretary, Sylvia Matthews Burwell, his choice to lead the Office of Management and Budget, Gene Sperling, Director of National Economic Council, Michael Froman, Senior White House Economic Advisors, are all acolytes of Robert Rubin, former Treasury Secretary and longtime Wall Street honcho at Goldman Sachs and Citigroup.
Right, right. Again, all of this starting in the Bush era. I'm not making any excuses for Obama.
Sure.
But, however, I will say that what happened was he came into office at a time when we literally had very serious people claiming that the banking system was about to totally collapse in on itself. And, of course, it's just a short extension to bringing down not only the U.S. economy, but the worldwide economy as well. You know, total, utter, unimaginable catastrophe supposedly facing us at that time. And there was a lot of truth behind that. And so Obama steps into office, part political neophyte, but complete financial neophyte. And what's a poor new president to do, but to rely on those who have been there and have been at the helm of all this. And these are the people that, notwithstanding the fact that they got us into this mess, were the best ones to figure out on how to get us out of it. So, yes, we do have a huge holdover from that era that's continued on into the Obama administration. And, you know, without speculating, one can only hope that once we get through this phase in our history, whether Obama's still in office or not, that, you know, we'll be able to move on and at least hire people from other banks than Goldman Sachs. Come on.
Let me ask you this. You know, you're a person who has seen high finance up close, has done analysis for that industry. You've seen also, you know, we've all been through this economic debacle that was the end of the second Bush tour. Do you see, you know, we've even heard the Attorney General say that, you know, he and the regulators really don't enforce laws. There's no real practical regulation going on. Is this one end of a pendulum swing, do you think? Do you think we're going to go back toward more regulation, or do you think that this part of the swing hasn't really finished its arc yet?
Oh, I wish I had a crystal ball. I mean, there's the one side of me. Yeah. I mean, there's the one side of me that has the hope and the prayer and the optimism to answer your question in the affirmative. However, there's the practical, realistic side of me that says this isn't going to go away overnight. And we are going to continue with the present mess. If for no other reason, Rick, there is just so much money out there. In terms of, you know, what corporations and their lobbying arms have been able to amass in you know, to get their way and to perpetuate their interests. I mean, when we look at some lobbying numbers, we've got and you break them out by industry. Banking, securities, and investments, to nobody's surprise, I should hope, it ranks it right at the top. This is an industry that in 2012 alone spent close to $250 million. Then the next rank is the pharmaceutical and the healthcare industry, which spent $232 million. The insurance industry, $150 million. So when you start adding up all these numbers, I mean, you're looking at just billions and billions of dollars that is, you know, still floating around out there, hasn't been spent. In fact, just, you know, adding up the top, what have I got here, like the top 20 industries, just those industries alone, have over $2 billion in their coffers ready to, you know, put to work here. And that's just in 1 year. I mean, it, you know, you multiply this number by next year and the year after and the year after. And, you know, and we're facing a time when corporate profits are at record heights, but companies aren't spending because of the sluggish economy. So corporate treasuries are fat and rich, and they're just, you know, looking for ways to spend some of this money, and, you know, and they get a good return on their investment, you know, in the whole grand scheme of things. It doesn't take that much money, you know, to buy your way onto a congressional staff position where you literally can write the laws, or into a lobbying position. And this is bound to continue. I really don't think that we're going to get any change until as a country, the focus starts moving off of money. How can I put this? Until we start moving into ways, more other ways to invest all the money that we have in our economy, you know, new industries, new products, innovation, new technology, and we're not there. I mean, you know, there's only so much opportunity that the internet field has to offer. There's only so much opportunity that, you know, the new technology fields have to offer. But yet we've got some pretty exciting stuff on the horizon, you know, like what's coming out of the Human Genome Project and other areas. But, you know, there's a big gap. And so, you know, coming back and answering your question, I don't think we've seen this arc really starting to swing back in any meaningful way yet.
Let me ask you to hold there for a moment.
Sure.
I want to make a brief announcement, then I'm going to have you sum up your thoughts. I do want to mention before the evening is out that Progressive News Network encourages you to patronize our other progressive journalist colleagues. I want to mention the quality show Here Be Monsters by Gwen Holden Berry, Miss Susan Nylon's Nylon Report, Brian Stetton's Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart's Wise Women. Also want to mention Sita Begul's show up in the Melbourne area. There are many good progressive shows out there. I hope you tune in. And now let me return to my author, Ms. Shaker. Why don't you go ahead and tell us one good thing that's going on about this situation? Renee, what do you think?
Well, it's not obvious yet, but it's only starting to make itself felt. What is happening is corporate shareholders are starting to step in and put a brake on some of this. Ultimately, managements of any companies, the people who spend the money to buy their way into Congress to write the legislation, you know, ultimately they're all accountable to their shareholders. And you've got a lot of activism that's really starting to ramp up now. It's been around for a while, but it's ramping up in a big way. And it's starting to go to these corporations, and it's starting to say, whoa, enough is enough. And in the areas in that they're focusing on is, you know, how these companies are spending their money in terms of corporate compensation packages, and other investment, quote-unquote, that is not germane to the running of the business. And I think that's going to be a good area to watch. You know, the corporate activism is rising, and if anybody has a chance to put a brakes on all this, it's the people who own these companies where their managements are out there spending like drunken sailors.
Well, many years ago, I once proposed to a peace activist group that what we should do is pool our pennies and invest in a timeshare of a legislator. And they thought I was joking, but clearly that's the way to go.
Hey, I think that's a great idea. I'll sign up for that. Not the
Renee,
legislature, but contributing to it.
Thank you so much for joining us. Why don't you tell everybody the name of your book again?
Confessions of an Ex-Reaganite. And basically, it's a personal journey. There are a lot of us baby boomers who voted for Reagan very enthusiastically in 1980, and we turn around and we find ourselves working on the Obama campaign, and the question is, how did that happen? So it's still a work in progress, but it's coming along nicely, and I hope to be able to give you a release date sometime real soon.
Thank you so much, Renee. It's been a real pleasure talking to you and a real pleasant way to end the show tonight. Thanks again. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Rick.
You're very welcome. My friends, I hope you tune in next week. We have something a little lighter in store for you. We've got some artists and some musicians and comedians on next week. It's a lighthearted show to lift your spirits, and hope you tune in next week when Progressive News Network presents The Art Show. So thanks again. Talk to you soon, and we'll see you next week. This is Rick Spezak, News Director, saying there's a better world to come in.
There's a better world is a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world is a-coming, tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world is a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world is a-coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is a-coming, don't you see?